Good evening and welcome to my nightmare. I'm Mark Kermode and that is the sound of horror, or more precisely, it was the sound of horror for thousands of moviegoers who, between the late 50s and early 70s, flocked to the cinema to pay homage at the eerie altar of Hammer Films. From humble beginnings as a ramshackle production company to international success as one of the movie world's most prolific film houses, Hammer came to embody the very best in chilling screen entertainment. Over the next hour, we'll be meeting the people behind the scenes at Hammer, the writers, directors, composers and producers who gave birth to a company which changed the face of modern cinema. We'll be hearing how Frankenstein was created, how Dracula was reborn, and how blood was liberally spilled from the mummy's tomb. We'll be meeting some of the people who got splattered with on-screen blood in the name of movie art, and we'll be asking a couple of bloodthirsty critics just how timeless and immortal the Hammer films really were.
What kind of danger?
I don't know what. I just feel that something's wrong. Did you feel that?
Yes. Something seemed to...
The story of Hammer Films dates back to the mid-1950s and the setting up of the company's legendary Bray Studios. Anthony Hines was one of the founding fathers of Hammer Films and remembers how they first stumbled across the location.
My chief electrician and my master carpenter told me that they had noticed a house which was known locally as Duffelcoat Manor because it had been used after the war for storing duffelcoats, and the roof had leaked and the duffelcoats had taken up so much water that the weight had caused the inside to collapse, so really it was a shell. So I went back to look at this, and we decided that we could turn this into a sort of studio. So that's what Bray Studios started from. It was just a house with an inside ripped out.
As unlikely as the location for Bray Studios was the origin of the company's name, Hammer. As Anthony Hines remembered, the trademark, which would soon become synonymous with international big-screen chills, actually had its roots in the theatrical comedy in which his father dabbled.
He was actually a retail jeweller, Hines Jewellers. But his heart wasn't in it. He always wanted to be on the stage as a comic. Unfortunately, he wasn't very funny and he wasn't very successful. But one of the acts he did was with another friend of his, and as my father's office was in Hammersmith, they called themselves Hammer and Smith. So father was Hammer and the other chap was Smith, and that's where the name Hammer came from.
I take back everything I said. I've never been so scared in all my life.
In the early days of the company, long before they began specialising in horror movies, Hammer were industriously making films based on then-popular steam radio serials, such as Dick Barton's Special Agent, The Man in Black, PC-49, and of course Life with the Lions. Then, in 1956, they broadened their horizons from adaptations of wireless shows to big-screen versions of TV programmes. The first project which seemed to fit the bill was an eerie BBC TV serial written by Nigel Neal, The Quatermass Experiment.
I saw the first instalment of Quatermass on BBC television, and I went up to town. I was actually working at the studio. I deliberately went up to town on the Monday and said to my partner, "You must watch this, it's marvellous." So he watched it, the second one, and I went up to see him. And on the next Monday, he said, "Come on, we'll go to the BBC." We went to see them and said we wanted to buy it, and they said we had some very good offers. And my partner immediately said, "Well, we'll split 50-50. They said, "Done." And that was it, so we bought it.
Although he'd been enthusiastic about the project, Tony Hines had little idea just how successful the movie would be. A suspenseful science fiction yarn about a young astronaut whose body is invaded by an unearthly presence, the Quatermass Experiment achieved an unsettling tone quite unlike anything else in British cinema. As film critic Alan Jones remembers, it also demonstrated Hammer's unique ability to forge original material from tried and tested ingredients.
Hammer, of course, were very good at sort of using old Hollywood stars who were past their peak in America, which is why you've got Brian Donlevy in this particular film as Professor Quatermass. And, of course, their resourcefulness in the special effects area was absolutely amazing, because in the Quatermass Experiment, the monster really was a piece of tripe bought from the local butcher.
The end of the film is about a broadcast, television broadcast from Westminster Abbey, where the television cameras suddenly pick up something up in the roof, in the scaffolding of the roof. The Abbey's supposed to be under repair. And indeed, we made a little model of the scaffolding of the roof, which looked like a clothes horse probably. And indeed, what the special effects did is they got some tripe and twisted it around all these bits of scaffolding, miniature scaffolding, and then ran the camera backwards and released it, and it looked as if the thing was twining itself, but in fact it was untwining. That's in fact how it was done.
At last he'll be able to show the world of science just how little it knows.
While the on-screen effects may have been just a touch hokey, they were lent a powerful credibility by the music of James Bernard. Having written dramatic scores for radio plays like John Webster's bloody tragedy, The Duchess of Malfi, Bernard was eager to break into filmmaking. As it turned out, Hammer needed him as much as he needed them.
John Hollingsworth had become music director to Hammer Films, and Anthony Hines rang up John in a bit of a panic and said, "We're doing this film, The Quatermass Experiment, and the composer who was to have done it is ill and can't. Have you got anybody up your sleeve who might be suitable?" So John rushed off to Bray Studios with the tape of my Duchess of Malfi music, and that's how I got into movies. Really, you can't write the score until the film is almost complete. The music is completely tailored to the action, particularly in these kind of films. I mean, you need to have a lot of synchronization, so you can't really get down to the score in detail until the film is finished. And of course, by then, they may want the score, because the composer's the last person to come in, and so all the crew have gone, and they want to get the whole thing wrapped up, and they have a delivery date. 5 weeks would be total luxury in those days, but it was more usually about four. And then it's total panic from then on.
Although James Bernard had never written a science fiction score before, he understood that for the Quatermass experiment to work, his music would have to convince the audience that they were indeed in the presence of something alien and unearthly.
It's about a man being invaded by a horrific entity from outer space and becoming a monster, as no doubt you know. So one had to think of this kind of soulless, alarming, sort of bleak music. I thought of a little very, very simple theme, which I used throughout. I mean, it's a sort of soulless little theme. One felt terribly sorry for this poor man, played by Richard Wordsworth brilliantly, who turns into through being prepared to take part in an experiment of being shot into space, he becomes invaded by this entity, and he's trying to retain his humanity, and of course it gets slowly swamped by this horrific monster into which he turns.
For James Bernard, it was the central character's isolation which provided the key to Quatermass's haunting musical score. For the paying audience, however, it wasn't isolation that attracted them to the movie. Quite the opposite, in fact.
People were going along, really wanted a script. It's a perfect date movie, you know, for that particular time. Friday night, Saturday night, out with a girlfriend, get them to scream, they'd leap on top of you. That's what Hammer films were good for.
Film critic Alan Jones, who points out that as well as the eerie music and startling special effects, there was another magic ingredient helping to sell the Quatermass experiment.
The significance of the Quatermass experiment is mainly the fact that experiment was spelt with a huge X to sort of emphasise the X certificate material that was in it. Like, this is so scary, you know, you're really going to be hiding behind your cinema seats. And of course it was for that particular time, and that's one of the reasons that put Hammer on the map, when they weren't afraid to go for the horror that other people shied away from. At that time, the X certificate was seen as something a bit sort of like, ooh, you know, a bit ashamed of this. We don't really want an X certificate on the movies, but of course Hammer came out and said, yes, we do, because they knew then that there would be money in the box office if they did so.
We reckoned it was a selling point. In America, of course, they play them in children's holidays because they regarded them as children's films, but here they were regarded as unsuitable for children, and we did used to go for the X, yes. I used to have constant battles with the censor. He was very unfair with us, I think.
producer Anthony Hines. Censor trouble aside, Hines learned from the success of Quatermass that there was money to be made from horror. Straight away, Hammer began looking around for other monster properties to exploit, and in 1957, they released The Curse of Frankenstein, starring Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. Not only did the movie change the face of modern cinema, it also cemented the Hammer team's reputation as the world's premier house of horror.
It did put into play the four core people anyway, of Peter Cushing, of Christopher Lee, the two stars, of Terence Fisher, the director, and Jimmy Sangster, the screenwriter. Those four became a pivotal and a crucial part of the whole Hammer formula. Phil Leakey, who was the major makeup man at Hammer at the time, completely devised a whole new monster look for Christopher Lee out of just rubber, which just went on his face, and he sort of did it as like after a car crash had happened. That was the look there. And again, it was very effective. Also, it was the very first horror film in colour, in a way, British horror film in colour. That was one of the reasons why it did so well. For the first time ever, Fisher could actually show you the blood, the gore, and have it on the screen for real. It was very, very shocking at the time. Also, they played up very much on the sexual elements of the story too, so you had heaving bosoms everywhere. So with that emphasis on the gore and the sexuality, that was the reason why Hammer did so well with that particular film.
I told you I was at the last stage but one. The brain of superior intellect. A lifetime of knowledge already behind it. Imagine that, Paul. My creature will be born with a lifetime of knowledge.
Victor, where is this brain to come from?
I'll get it.
With Frankenstein drawing ever larger crowds, all hungry for horror, Hammer looked inevitably to other established gothic texts from which to derive another modern hit. As Anthony Hines remembers, the idea of remaking Frankenstein originally came through the company's flamboyant chief, Jim, later Sir James, Carreras.
How the Frankenstein got set up was that Jim came and said that some Americans that he knew had got the rights of Frankenstein, and they got a script. He wanted me to do it, and I read it, and I thought it was pretty crummy, and I didn't really want to do it at all. Then I remember saying to him once, you realise that Frankenstein's in public domain. It was written by Mary Shelley. Well, he hadn't known that, you see, and he suddenly dashed off and came back and said, oh, to hell with them, we'll make it, you see, ourselves. It wasn't a very big budget, and I was a bit worried about that because I was always a great admirer of the original Frankenstein film. I thought it was a great film. I thought Dracula was a load of all rubbish, but I thought the original Frankenstein was absolute first class, and I didn't really want to make a second-rate version of it. Then our lawyer pointed out that the lawyers at Universal were standing behind the door with a writ in their hand, just waiting to serve it on us if we used any of the ideas that they put in their film that weren't in the original book. Well, I was delighted because it meant that we could start afresh and make our own Frankenstein. And then I approached Jimmy Sangster and asked if he wanted to have a go at the script. And that's how it all started.
Like so many of the people whose careers were nurtured by the success of Hines and Carreras, Jimmy Sangster was already working for the Hammer stable, but not as a scriptwriter.
How did I become a writer, basically? I became a writer because Hammer, I was production manager, Hammer had just made the Quatermass Experiment from a BBC serial, and it had been a runaway success in the cinemas. They were as surprised as anybody, and they said, we must do another one of these. But there weren't any sort of particular lying around, not that Hammer could afford. And we were just sitting around the office one day, Tony Hines, Michael and myself, Michael Carreras and myself, and I said, well, how about a story where so-and-so happens? And Michael said, yeah, well, maybe then afterwards such and such. And Tony said, yeah, but wouldn't it be better if... And after about 30 minutes, we'd sort of talked a story. And Tony said to me, well, you talk most of it. Go away and write it. I said, I'm not a writer, I'm a production manager. He said, well, we're paying you as a production manager. Now go away and write. If we like it, we'll, if we use it, we'll pay you as a script. And so I went away and I wrote it, and they liked it, and they paid me, and I became a writer. And that was X the Unknown, the movie was called. And then I was production manager on X the Unknown, and so I was still on staff when they decided, and I'm not sure what decided them to, somebody must have come up with the idea of redoing the Frankenstein. They said, we're going to do the Frankenstein film, and they said, would you like to write it? And there was no sort of, if we like it, we'll pay you this time. They said, we will give you a fee. It is £450. So I wrote Frankenstein.
You killed the old man, didn't you? You killed him and now you're mutilating his body.
Mutilating? I've removed his brain. Mutilating has nothing to do with it.
I can't prove you murdered him, but I can stop you using his brain.
Why? He has no further use for it.
Don't be a fool. Be careful! Who damn it!
I mean, there's been never been a Frankenstein picture where, at the end, the villagers don't storm the castle. No villagers for Hammer. We couldn't afford villagers. And the picture was going to be made for, I can't remember the amount, something like £60,000-£70,000, something like that. And I had to write within those restrictions, which I could do because I was a production manager and I was going to budget it as well as I finished, so there was no point in writing the exterior of 4,000 villagers if I knew I was going to have to budget for them. We didn't have the money. How did I write it? I mean, I thought I stuck pretty close to the story. What I did do was I thought Frankenstein, Baron Frankenstein, was a much more interesting character than the monster. So I made him the villain. I mean, really, a thoroughly nasty piece of work.
You promised to marry me. I'm not forgetting that.
Yeah, so I did.
Don't you laugh at me. Stop it. Stop it, or I'll...
What? What will you do?
I kill you.
You stupid little fool. Did you really think that I'd marry you?
You're hurting.
Get back to your work.
But you've got to marry me. You've got to. I'm going to have a child.
As well as bringing together the creative team who have produced much of Hammer's finest work, The Curse of Frankenstein also introduced one of composer James Bernard's most endearing musical quirks, that of taking the rhythm for a movie's theme from the rhythm of its title. It was to become a trademark of Hammer films.
I do use, as I have said before, I do sometimes use the name of a film to give me a start in thinking of a theme, and the music for The Curse of Frankenstein does kind of go to the rhythm of The Curse of Frankenstein. I can't remember exactly how it goes. Christopher Lee was marvellous as the monster, wasn't he? I mean, he was very pathetic and sad, and I suppose I did have that element in the score, that how sad for this poor monster lumbering about and who's been created and hasn't wanted to be created. I think I felt very sorry for him.
Just as the first wave of mainstream horror films in the 1930s had created superstars of the genre, so Hammer films now strove to nurture their very own stable of saleable monsters. Film critic and novelist Kim Newman.
There's always been a tradition of the horror star. Universal Pictures created their own stars, Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi, most successfully. I think it's almost accidental that Hammer did the same thing, simply by casting Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee in Curse of Frankenstein. Cushing came out of a theatre and a TV background. He wasn't particularly well known as a film actor, but he was, you know, unquestionably a good, solid, all-round actor, the kind of person who was, you know, invited into your homes for playing in The Winslow Boy on television, although he'd also done 1984. Christopher Lee got the job because Bernard Breslau's agent asked for too much money. They were apparently the only two actors over the height requirement to play the Frankenstein monster. If Bernard Breslau's agent had been a bit more generous that week, Bernard Breslau would presumably have gone on to play Dracula and become the biggest horror star of the 60s. If you look at Lee's performance in Curse of Frankenstein, he's pretty good given the limits of it, but it's not really until he played Dracula that he became a horror star. And even in the original Dracula, he doesn't have that much to do. It's still a film that stars Peter Cushing.
If Peter Cushing was the leading light as far as the thespian honours were concerned, then Christopher Lee brought a somewhat more racy element to the proceedings, which would be equally important in selling Hammer films to a wider audience. Critic Alan Jones.
Dracula was so shocking for the period because audiences had never seen sexuality played up so much on screen. I mean, when you look at it now, with old Chris Lee sort of smouldering away, it doesn't look much. But at that time, of course, it was quite hot stuff. He became a sex symbol overnight because of that film, really. Not just a sort of a horror icon, but a sex symbol as well. Remember, I mean, men would take girls to the cinema at that time. And the girls had to have something to sort of respond to, and of course they did in Christopher Lee. And therefore the horror became even more potent as a result of their attraction to him.
The thing about Peter, and I think he helped enormously to make the films popular, was he could take the stupidest line and make it sound important. I mean, I wrote a lot of the lines, and I know he could make anything sound important, and he always treated his work very seriously. Christopher, he was fine as the monster in Frankenstein, and then he was super as Dracula. I mean, thanks to everybody else, to Bernie Robinson and to the cameraman and all, and to Terry, he was super as Dracula. And then he went on to deny, then he went on to say, to knock it. And he knocked it for years. But it is my contention that made him a star.
Well, Jimmy Sangster remembers Christopher Lee's reluctance to embrace his horror heritage, so it was Peter Cushing's sometimes overbearing professionalism that stands out in the memory of Anthony Hines.
Peter was very difficult because he was terribly fussy and terribly worried about everything should be right, and he used to sometimes come and see the rushes, and he might see a shot that was done, which say a Penning shot establishing the Dartmoor for Hound of the Baskervilles, and at the end of the Penning shot a car appeared in the distance. Well, anybody sitting in the theatre would have known that you're not going to include that bit. I mean, you cut before, but he'd get an estate and he'd phone his agent and phone my partner. He'd never speak to me about that. But on a personal basis, he was a very likeable man. And he loved a joke. In fact, he'd empty a restaurant. If he started laughing, people would leave. You know, he tried to joke so much. But he was fine. But he was fussy about his props, his costume and everything. Chris was great. I mean, I got on well with Chris. Chris was, he loved a joke. He did marvellous impersonations of W.C. Fields and people. He was also a marvellous opera singer. And funny enough, our makeup man at the time was interested in music, and he was a good singer, an opera singer. They used to sing away in the makeup room at the beginning, early in the morning. Terrible.
Ah, well, you know what they say. All opera is basically fat people shouting at each other. By 1958, Hammer had established itself as a major force in movies, capable of bringing out the very best in British filmmakers. Alongside Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing and Jimmy Sangster, Hammer had also revived the career of veteran director Terence Fisher, who did such an impressive job on The Curse of Frankenstein. From here, Fisher went on to tackle pretty much all of the major horror movie icons in films like Dracula, The Mummy, The Hound of the Baskervilles, The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, The Curse of the Werewolf and The Phantom of the Opera. Although he's now hailed as one of the great artists of British Gothic cinema, Fisher apparently viewed each project as just another job, as did screenwriter Jimmy Sangster.
Well, let's take Terry Fisher first, the director. He was just as surprised as everybody else, because he'd been at Hammer, he'd done two or three, I'd been his assistant director on two or three other films. He happened to be at Hammer when Hammer did their first thing, so he was asked to do it, because we knew he'd do it on time and do it right. So he became a hugely celebrated horror film writer. Horror film director, if he was still alive, bless him, he'd say exactly the same. He was just as surprised as everybody else. Peter was a darling man, a real gentleman. He never liked my scripts, apparently, according to a book I've just read. He didn't think I could write. But there is the story, which you probably have heard. Christopher came back to do a Dracula part after a long time, and there was no dialogue for him, and Peter Cushing said, "Be thankful for small mercies." If it's a Sangster script, be thankful for small mercies.
Despite Peter Cushing's apparent derision, Jimmy Sangster clearly did have what it took to draw out the most cinematic elements of a classic Gothic tale, and do it within an extremely tight budget. With Frankenstein pulling in the crowds for Hammer in such a lucrative manner, Sangster was pretty much compelled to put pen to paper for the company's inevitable sister project.
Frankenstein opened, and I almost immediately, I was a hot property. And I think the first thing I did, I went off and wrote a... No, I wrote the other one for Hammer. I'm sorry, I wrote Dracula for Hammer. Same sort of thing. We're going to make Dracula. Thanks to did a script, okay script on Frankenstein, let's get him to do Dracula. I got paid a bit more for Dracula. I think I got paid £750 for Dracula. But, and I've said this before, and I say it in my book, it was just another movie. They were all just another movie. If the first movie I'd written, if Hammer had gone into making the first successful movie had been a carry-on, I would have been a carry-on writer. But it wasn't. It was a horror film. I became a horror film writer.
If Jimmy Sangster was caught unawares by his success, then composer James Bernard was equally surprised to find himself branded one of the world's leading horror maestros. Naturally, when Dracula went into production, Bernard was duly summoned from the crypt to provide a characteristically spine-tingling theme. Although this time, of course, he had rather less to go on.
Just the notes of Dracula, just a drop of it. I don't think I'm very bad at singing in tune. We must forgive that. But, I mean, it was just that. And it all came from that. And developing it from there. So that was a very, very simple one. I think in that movie, the element of horror was uppermost, and I think the only moment where the score can relax is where, is it Lucy, who, she's the girl who becomes a vampire quite early on, and she lures the little girl, who calls her Aunt Lucy, or I think that's right, and Peter Cushing has to give her the steak treatment. there's a scene there where, if you remember, the camera's held on her face as she turns from the living dead into the properly dead. And that was a passage of music where I was able to use sort of major chords and a feeling of peace and serenity. In my own experience, I've always found that you've got to get right into the characters and go with them and really try to express it. And if Dracula has got the sort of bloodlust on him, you've got to try and get that into the music, and you've got to try and get the horror into it, and you cannot sit back and relax. And I used to try and think myself into how Dracula would be feeling for a particular section of music, which was rather horrific. And it was quite a strain. But I thought it's too much, and there's too much fast, insistent music. But then you think, no, I've got to go on until the climax, and it's got to be discordant, and it's got to be exciting, and you cannot relax for one moment.
Composer James Bernard. For all its frenetic chase sequences and haunting atmospheric set pieces, it was the startling climax of Dracula that would be imprinted most indelibly on many viewers' minds, as Alan Jones remembers only too well.
Nobody who saw that at the time will ever forget Peter Cushing on top of that table, rushing down, pulling down the curtains, letting the shaft of light fall on Christopher Lee's Dracula and his whole body melting. That was so shocking at the time.
This is BBC Radio 2, and you're listening to the rise and fall of the House of Hammer. Now, for proof of the undying appeal of both the 1957 Curse of Frankenstein and 58 Dracula, you need look no further than the shelves of your local video dealer, where both movies have just been issued for the first time. On the back of their original success, Hammer moved boldly into the 60s, with director Freddie Francis first joining the company and settling in just as Hammer were embarking on their second wave of horrors. For Francis, working for Hammer meant carrying on the business's success, directing sequels like Evil of Frankenstein and Dracula Has Risen from the Grave.
They had the studio all set up at Bray, and it was an ongoing thing, because they were a wonderful business organisation, Hammer. I mean, I sort of often upset, when I'm lecturing, I often upset students of horror films by calling them a business organisation, but they were absolutely brilliant. I mean, Jim Carreras, Tony Hines, And Michael Carreras, they ran it so brilliantly. It was a pity they didn't stay and make all sorts of different films. Why should they? They hit upon this magic formula, and they carried on that way.
It is a living force, which can be tapped at any given moment of the night.
First film I directed was a film called Paranoiac, which I enjoyed very much because I enjoyed it, because I enjoyed directing films, and because it was so easy to work for Hammer. You know that there wasn't a great deal of money, but you knew exactly where you stood, and the thing was organised so that nobody ever went over budget or schedule. And one always had, because they had a permanent crew down there at Bray, they were nice people, they were friendly, and the whole thing went like clockwork, so it was most enjoyable.
As Freddie Francis had noticed, Hammer were always canny about cost-cutting and budget-stretching. It was a formula which Anthony Hines was to develop into an international art, although art itself was not always best served.
I went across to America with Jim Carreras, and a chap in the Columbia office, I think, he turned on me and said, "You said you were going to make the pictures cheaper, and you haven't." And anyway, I said, "Well, no, I can make these pictures for £100,000 for you. If you let me make them four at a time." So it was agreed. So I wrote a picture about Rasputin. And then I wrote one about Dracula. I can't remember whether I actually wrote the script. I think I wrote the scripts of both those, yes. And the thing was Rasputin. I don't remember that Rasputin died. He finally was thrown into the river Neva and disappeared under the ice. Well, we used the same actors and the same sets for this Dracula, you see. And at the end of the Dracula one, vampires are unable to cross running water, and Dracula's on an ice, he's on a frozen lake, and someone starts shooting at the ice, and it cracks up, and so the water runs, so he gets sucked down between. So you have two films, exactly the same actor, and exactly the same ending, you see. Well, then we did two that were set in the West Country. They were sort of simpler ones, one called The Reptile, and I forget what the other was. I wrote the story one, but not the script the other. That doesn't make any difference. We did the four, and the idea was they played one and three, two and four, you see. But unfortunately they didn't. It went out one and two. And there was a howl of protest from the audience about this. And they saw the same actors at the same sets. And probably the same dialogue as I wrote them both.
You can't only have good things, beautiful things, holy things. They're worthless without their opposites.
Although some of the Hammer movies weren't quite vintage fare, the company kept an extremely reputable profile thanks to the public face of Hammer frontman James Carreras. Actress Ingrid Pitt, who starred in The Vampire Lovers and Countess Dracula, remembers what a profound impression the amiable tycoon made on her.
Making Hammer films was especially wonderful because of Jimmy Carreras. And he was the most wonderful man. He was so professional, but he was so humorous too, and he was such a mensch, as they call him. And I just loved him to bits.
Actress Valerie Leon, star of Blood from the Mummy's Tomb, remembers Sir James Carreras and his producer-director son, Michael.
Sir James Carreras was a lovely man. He was a lovely man. I do remember him because I used to go to various charity functions and I would always meet him, and he would be charming, utterly charming. His eyes were very, very... They seemed to shine out of his face, I think, as I recall. I mean, you know, I didn't see much of him, but I just remember him as being a lovely, big personality. And Michael, as his son, must have inherited some of that charm, but I don't recall him being as charming as his father was.
For Anthony Hines, the key to Sir James's business charm was his flair for good old-fashioned showmanship.
We had a system of working. He would go to America to see the bosses at Columbia and Universal and Warner's and UA and all the rest in New York. And he would say to me before he goes, he said, Tony, have you got any ideas for films, you see? And I'd come up with some, possibly even just a title, like, you know, Creatures the World Forgot, or The Day the World Split Open, or something like that. I really had no idea of the story to go with. He's a great marvelous, you know. And he had little posters made, miniature posters, beautifully done, showing the world splitting open, showing the dinosaurs on the world and all the rest of it. And he'd take those, and then he'd go into Universal or something, and he suddenly open the door and say, draw and hold at the poster and say, how about that for 150,000, you see? And they'd look at that and say, well, we can't really lose with that, you know.
Breaking out of the gothic mould, Hammer also branched out into larger ventures, importing some of the verve of their horror movies into a series of fantastic adventure movies like 1 Million Years BC and She. The latter was a source of particular pleasure for composer James Bernard.
By the time they came to do She, I was longing to escape from gothic horror. I mean, I was very grateful to get the gothic horror scores to do, but I welcomed this kind of romantic adventure story, which does have, as you know, it has quite an element of horror, but it had got all the sort of mystery of She, Aisha, the immortal lady, 2,000 years old. And so it was a wonderful treat for me to get this score. It was a particularly hard one to do, I know, because it was, I think there was more music than normally I had done before, but it was lovely to have this completely different element in the score of this immortal woman living in a forgotten kingdom. It was a whole different scene, and I'd love to have had the chance to do more scores of that type.
Thank you. James Bernard's lavish and evocative theme from She, one of the more adventurous offerings from Hammer's mid-60s production line. Sadly, however, the sequels and retreads, which once kept the company on the road of financial success, were starting to seem increasingly drab to modern audiences hungry for more contemporary thrills. As their box office cachet began to dwindle, Hammer resorted to ever more desperate ploys to win back the crowds who had once filled their cinema seats.
Gradually, the films weren't selling as well. People had had enough of them, I'm sure. The censorship relaxed quite a bit, so you could do a tits and bums horror film. Well, I didn't fancy doing those. And then someone suggested we did some of the television comedy shows, like On the Buses, which were very successful, and that didn't interest me very much either. Then I found that my partner had put me up as a producer of a television series, and what he hadn't realised that they were going to start transmitting soon after we started shooting, and that meant that we'd have to make two at a time, and the whole thing became a nightmare, and I thought, well, to hell with this. I've got enough money, I don't need this, so I pulled out.
Seems like I've been involved all my life, doesn't it?
Maybe even longer.
But even as the Hammer organisation was starting to fall apart, the company continued to produce works which bore the stamp of individuality and invention. The Devil Rides Out, directed by Terence Fisher from Dennis Wheatley's Black Magic bestseller, was perhaps Hammer's last fully-fledged period horror. Once again, James Bernard's demonic score provided one of the film's most memorable elements. For some people, it even saved the movie.
When it was being made, Anthony Hines, for some reason, thought it wasn't coming off, it wasn't working well. The director was Terence Fisher, who was their best, one of their very best directors, and they had a wonderful cast. But I remember Tony ringing me and saying, Jimmy, I think we're going to have to rely a lot on the music. I don't think this film is working. I want you to come down and see what's going on. So I did go down, and what I saw, I thought it all looked absolutely fine. Coming back to The Devil Rides Out again, that sort of black mass or orgy scene where everybody's dressed in kind of white robes, which is when they're all sort of drinking blood and sort of working up to the appearance of the great goat of Mendes. That was all shot at night, so I didn't actually go down for the shooting of it, but that was a case where I had to write a bit of music which they could use during the shooting to dance to.
In the 70s, as censorship standards slackened, horror movies started to become more explicit, both in terms of horror and sex. As critic Kim Newman points out, Hammer had no choice but to follow suit.
Certainly, I think that Hammer put sex into their films in the 70s in a very calculated move in order to keep up with what was going on in the rest of cinema at the time. That was back when your X certificate meant saucy, permissive. In fact, it was one of the things that they did that didn't work for them, because okay, it meant that films like The Vampire Lovers, Lust for a Vampire, they attracted a bit of a raincoat cap crowd in Britain, but when they were exported to America, where still the horror movie audience was basically 12-year-olds, they had to cut all the sex out in order to get the necessary certificate for American kids to go and see them, and so those films tended to be incomprehensible in America and of course flopped.
Pitt has rather more down-to-earth memories of the roles which made her a screen icon.
The funniest thing on Count Dracula was when I was having my love scene with Shonda Rhimes in the hay, and he came up for air after nuzzling my Tom and Jerry, and he looked at me lovingly, and I fell about because half of his moustache was missing. Anyway, we had to look for this half a moustache in a haystack. You try and do that. So I got bored with it and went to my dressing room trailer or whatever it was. And since I had this tight corset on, I thought, I'm going to take everything off. It'll take them forever. So I took everything off, and lo and behold, where do you think half a moustache was? Stuck to my belly button.
If the disappearance of her leading man's moustache gave Ingrid Pitt something to laugh about, the removal of her voice from the soundtrack of Countess Dracula was more serious altogether. Pitt had put her soul into the performance, and she would find it very hard to forgive director Peter Sasdy for silencing her on-screen passion.
Maybe he shouldn't have given me the part, but on the other hand, maybe it was better to have the part and be revoiced than not have the part. I don't know, I think he took my soul away from my performance, and every time I see the film, I just shudder, because he gave her a very English, posh voice, which didn't fit Erzsébet Báthory, and she should have been a bitch, and it should have been in her voice, and there isn't one moment in the film where the voice expresses her soul, her torment, her anxieties, her villainous, her bitchiness, her nastiness, none of it is in there. And I just don't know why on earth he did that. And I'll never forgive him, because he and I used to go to the sound man all through the shooting, and he was happy with what I did. I did what Brando did in The Godfather, stuffed my mouth with cotton, and I thought it was really good what I did.
For many, the beginning of the end of Hammer Films came when the company moved out of Bray Studios in 1967, dissolving the family atmosphere which had once held the company together. Gradually, the stalwarts drifted away. A sense of an ending hung heavy in the air. The troubled shooting of Seth Holt's 1970 production, Blood from the Mummy's Tomb, seemed to mirror the demise of Hammer as a whole. Leading lady Valerie Leon remembers how the dream turned sour.
I was thrilled to be working with Peter Cushing, who was cast as my father. And on the first day of shooting, we did the very important scene where he hands me the ring for my 21st birthday present, the ring which, in fact, he'd removed from the dead hand of Tera, the Egyptian queen. And he was a lovely man to work with, kind, gentle, a gentleman in every respect. This is what I recall of him in that brief time we had together. I believe we only worked one day, that I can't remember, but we certainly did a day's shooting, if not possibly two. And then he suddenly heard that his wife had been taken to Canterbury Hospital, I think it was, and she'd been ill for a number of years, and he requested to be released from the movie, and I actually think she died 2 weeks later, and he never recovered from that, although he continued to work. But I was really sad, because obviously Peter Cushing, being the name he was, it would have brought a totally different tone to the movie. his role was taken over by Andrew Kerr, who was a lovely man also, but obviously played it in a completely different way than Peter would have done. So that was the first tragedy. And, of course, Seth Holt dying was the second tragedy. It was almost as if it was my first starring role, and there was a curse on it. Instead of blood from the mummy's tomb, one almost felt it should have been curse from the mummy's tomb because of those two terrible things happening.
Alec, your father must have been driven by some occult knowledge that even he was unaware he possessed. It was his destiny.
And what then?
Then, horror, wonder. There was an attack on one of our bearers, and at that moment, horrifyingly, fresh blood was released in her veins. How could this be? How could she be so perfectly preserved? And you, born exactly at the moment that your father first looked on her, born in her image, born as we spoke her name, which the priests hadn't entirely obliterated. Tara.
In a strange way, Blood from Mummy's Tomb is one of my favourite later period Hammer films. It's kind of incoherent, presumably because the director died midway through shooting it and the producer had to take over to finish it. That said, it's got strange things in it that other Hammer films don't have. It has an ambiguous ending and a contemporary setting. At the end of Blood from Mummy's Tomb, almost for the first time in Hammer horror history, first the good guy, the Dr. Van Helsing figure, gets killed. Then the hero, the nice young man who's supposed to rescue the heroine, he gets killed as well. And at the end, you're not sure whether the heroine has survived or whether the ancient and evil Egyptian sorceress queen has survived. And it doesn't much matter because, you know, the heroine's personality has been so severely traumatized by all she's gone through that survival is all she can have. There is no happy ending.
Even though Hammer did go on to make On the Buses, as Alan Jones remembers, by the early 1970s, they had definitely missed the bus.
The very points of why people liked Hammer films so much, their very Britishness, the whole costume drama, the sort of the elegance of them, finally sort of became dated. And of course, then in 1973, The Exorcist was released and it changed everything. You could not compete. And so what were Hammer doing? I mean, they sort of decided, well, we'd better start trying a possession-type movie. So they went to The Devil, A Daughter, which, of course, is their last film released today. And, of course, that was hopeless. They didn't have the budget or the resources to do it as well as the Americans of that time, who suddenly realised that horror could be mainstream and big-budget and blockbuster.
After the release of To the Devil, A Daughter, Hammer ceased production of horror movies altogether. Yet in the 20 years since 1976, the Hammer brand name has retained a potent cachet unmatched anywhere else in the genre. Announcements in recent years of an imminent revival of Hammer horror have thrilled many diehard fans. But should the company really attempt to rise again from the grave?
I would love to see that there's a future for Hammer. Back in 1993, we heard the amazing news that, yes, Hammer's reborn, it's rising again out of the ashes, we're going to remake lots of our old titles, we're going to be back out there, and since then nothing's happened.
Hammer may not be undead, and maybe it'll never rise again from the grave, but its films certainly live on. The entire Hammer back catalogue has for years fed the late-night TV circuit, and most of the films we've talked about tonight are still available and indeed still selling on home video. Clearly the word Hammer does still mean something in the 90s.
You could go up to most people in any part of the world and say, do you know what a Hammer film is? And they will know. They will know Christopher Lee as Dracula. And you can't honestly say that about any other film company, possibly apart from, say, somebody like Steven Spielberg, who they'd know. But if you say Hammer, it immediately conjures up a whole sort of gothic atmosphere of blood, of horror, of heaving bosoms, of silly monsters, and of moments spent in the cinema back in the 60s.
But for writer, producer, and indeed director Jimmy Sangster, the legend of Hammer lies in the past.
The Hammer which people remember was Terry Fisher and Tony Hines and Peter Cushing. It was the people. It was the people who produced the product. The people just aren't there anymore. And if Hammer is regenerated, it's going to be with completely new people, and
making new product, and what, you know, what's the point? They're not going to remake the old product, because that's not one. People don't want to see that anymore. So what are they going to do? They're just going to be another film company. So I don't know, this rejuvenation of Hammer, I don't know what it consists of.
Oh my God, look!
Last word to James Bernard, who has nothing but positive recollections of his time spent in the House of Hammer.
Oh, I have excellent memories, only happy memories, and I'm very proud to have been part of the whole Hammer scene. And for me as a composer, because I've never been a writer of symphonies and sonatas and oratorios or an operas, this is my only claim to fame as a composer, really, because I've never been a concert composer, and therefore it's always thrills me to think that over the years since I started in movies in 1954, that millions of people all over the world have heard my music, though they may not have been actually conscious of it, and that in recent years they've become more and more conscious of it, because there's such an interest in film music. And it thrills me very much that so many young people really seem to like my scores. It gives me a great deal of pride and delight.
Composer James Bernard. Well, the sun's coming up, and it's time for me to crawl back into my coffin. I'm Mark Kermode. The Rise and Fall of the House of Hammer was written by Kim Newman and myself. This has been a peer production by John Tuckey for BBC Radio 2.